You are listening to Future Based Podcast. Future Based is an interdisciplinary philosophy platform. For more information, visit futurebased.org. Future Based Podcast series on more than human relations is hosted by Michelle Gerards. Michelle is a PhD student at the University of Amsterdam's Department of Anthropology with a specialization on natural resources. She's familiar with regular as well as the creative approaches to qualitative research. Having collaborated with artists, she supports the idea of research as a serious play and aims to explore the blurry borderline between the natural and the artificial. If you are interested in questioning established frameworks of our knowledge and the nature of existence or being as such, this is the podcast for you. In this very first episode, Michelle goes into conversation with artist and DJ Vanessa Opoku. Vanessa is a visual artist, filmmaker and DJ, and lives and works in Berlin, Germany. Through film, AI, 3D scanning among other, she researches how we can radically change the concept of our world. One of our most recent works is Chapter 1 Landscape. Michelle and Vanessa met each other at the Fiberspace Festival initiative Cartographies of the Vanishing Now Lab, a five-day art science laboratory which took place in Amsterdam in 2019.
Vanessa, we spoke to each other before. It was in September 2019 during the Cartographies of the Vanishing Now Lab in Amsterdam. We then discussed how art can help relate to crisis by creating a physical experience. We went into the field for artistic research and we had talks about artistic research, how landscaping affects your work, and how storytelling bridges gaps between skills. You told me something about what was then a work in progress and how you worked with an AI and a 3D model of seagrass that you took from the field trip. So firstly, would you like to tell me something about what you currently work on as an artist?
I'm still working on Chapter 1 Landscape because I'm planning on doing some other chapters for it. But Chapter 1 Landscape was actually the first time that I brought together thoughts that were in my head for quite some time already. And I first engaged with the subject of landscape 2 years ago. Maybe I can talk about that a little bit. I mean, of course, landscape was something I was aware of before, but I did not work on it artistically. And back then, I spent 8 months in Jerusalem. I think I told you about that. And through a friend of mine who is a landscape architect herself, I came to know Ruth Ennis. Ruth Ennis is a landscape architect. She lives in Haifa. And her biography tells stories of things I worked on before or felt connected in one way or the other. For example, the conditions of exile and the Shoah, for example. And she's in her 90s now, and she had an accident a few years ago where she lost her memory. And I found it super interesting that there was landscape architect, you know, and the connection between landscape and memory, that she lost it in a way. And she tries to reappropriate her own identity, so to say, through reading her publications. And after a few days of filming and interviewing, because we did some interviewing with her, I felt that like the separation between fact and fiction is not that easy. It is also not the most interesting part in this, if this is real or not, or if this is a fact that she's telling me. And in the end, I'm interested in her reality, and her reality is the one I have to take for granted. And we visited places that she built, for example, and she couldn't tell us anything about them. And also in the archive, there are so many strings that are connecting all through her. And if she cannot really put them together anymore, there was this question, so what happens when people shape the land, re-encounter and perceive as landscape, but the stories, how this landscape came to be, are fragmented. Or I never think that something is lost. But the question is always if we can read it. I mean, I said memory in terms of landscape and how we see it and how we make a space, a place. Memory plays an important role in perceiving landscape. And because memory, as I believe, ingrains itself into topos, into the land, maybe in terms of invisible layers. And I had to think about a text that I read. I mean, I also said that last time I read a text. But it kind of fits because it is from Sarah Covington, and she describes the layers, these invisible layers, in an example of Irish storytelling, where she says that in which features of the landscape, trees, rocks, fells, they imbued with tales of origin, implying, in Seamus Heaney's words, a system of reality beyond the visible realities. I think that can happen individually or collectively. And these layers allow for identification or sometimes also sacralization of a place. And I think now the question is, who can read these stories in these layers, for example? I also think that archiving plays an important role, because I believe that one should always be very critical with archives and biographies, also working with archives and biographies, since these can easily be used also as a form of oppression. They can be also used as power structures to hide one reality or story and amplify another.
Well, I actually really want to ask so many things based on what you just said. Well, one thing I find interesting is what you said about memory and the landscape, because I think a lot of reasons why we are currently in climate change or environmental crisis might be because we remember the landscape in a faulty way, or in a way that is represented through a certain hegemonial worldview. One might say like a capitalist one. We talked about this last time. Let's not repeat too much from that interview. That would be a shame. But still, I think the link to what you said about the line between fiction and nonfiction is blurring there, is something that brings arts to the front when you talk about environmental research. Because if you only want to focus on the facts, we might tend to get stuck in this idea of what a fact is and how that relates to the environment. I think what I'm trying to ask is how you learned from your artistic research that you were just talking about. Where did you find the experience and the landscape to make a story, or how did you experience that as a blurring of fiction and nonfiction, maybe with a specific example?
Well, I think there was one situation where I felt this blurring that you said between fiction and nonfiction, of fiction and fact, most visible, because I really liked the idea that every, a lot of places, maybe not every, you know, inch on this earth is a place of identification for someone. And I'm talking just about humans right now, of course, because I cannot say anything other than, you know, that's like my what I can best talk about. I kind of like this idea of these different layers, you know, that are kind of invisible, and some people can see them and read them and others can't. And I think then there's also this question, if you have to be part of a specific community, for example, to be able to read them, or do you have to have the same socialization to read them? You know, what are the parameters that enable you to read these layers in, and I mean, this is something I'm working right now on. I don't know if I should go there. Okay. I mean, we briefly talked about representation. This is also included in that. I'm working on artistic research, also with the help of AI again. And I'd like to understand AI or how I use it as a medium that I can contact to reach the hidden layers, like a medium in seances, or, you know, like coming back ghosts, so much in the sense of the role of a medium, which was used to contact the ancestors or contact ghosts. I mean, I don't see that in like an esoteric way or a spiritual way. For me, this is not the case. But I just like to understand AI as a medium that I engage with or contact.
So, and how do you work with AI in your new work? What do you do?
I'm trying to explain it briefly. I'm doing an artistic research about Jewish poet Masha Kaleko. She published, especially, she lived in Berlin in the 1920s and 30s, and she published poetry and short stories. And she was really connected with Charlottenburg and the Saviniplatz. And she always discusses this, or she always writes about this in her poems. And my she has a lot of stations in her biography. She was born in Western Galicia and then had to flee to Germany, lived in Berlin in the 20s and 30s, had to go into exile because of the Nazis in 38 to New York City, later made Aliyah to Jerusalem, to Israel, but never overcame this connection to Berlin. She never defined herself through national identity, for example. She always defined, I believe that she always defined herself as Berlin, over the Berlin identity. And also after the war, she comes back to Berlin and she's searching for her Berlin, you know, and she's talking about the stones that are speaking to her and the only people that also can listen and read these layers in these places are gone or dead, you know, and I feel like this is something really important that she says there. And she also destroyed a lot of her personal documents. And in interviews, she said, she always said, well, you have to read my poems, then you know the answer to your question, you know? So that's why it's important to me to only use the poems that she published and not look into her, you know, biography and that somebody wrote about her. Because that is something that was really important to her, to perceive herself, or maybe not herself, but that's what she wants to communicate, using this as the basis of your research, as in this work really important to me. And how I want to work with AI is that I'm thinking about feeding an AI with her poems, for example, and creating this lyrical persona or this lyrical ghost, which is not Masha Kaliko, but this it's constructed from thoughts of her and engaging in conversation with this ghost about the specific places that were important to her. And in this case, I'm not pretending that it's her, you know, because it's not a reconstruction of her as a person, but it's a reconstruction maybe of the ghost of the poems of her.
That's interesting. How do you feed them to the AI and what happens, what comes out?
That's something I have to research. And I mean, that is part of the research. Right now, I just have the idea on doing this. Last time I did this with Chapter One Landscape, crazy things came out of that because I felt like suddenly this AI is talking about how the word human came into existence, you know, and that there was this a story about sailors going to Hernia Island, and there was this battle of Hernia Island, and then there was a human on this ship, and this human woman, she changed her appearance into a terrible monster, you know, and destroyed everything around her, and because of this monster, you know, this word human came into existence, and this just came from the AI. So I was just really I really value these moments, you know, where stories like that come out of it, and it's somehow, it's not about fact, of course this didn't happen, there's no Hernia Island, there was never battle of Hernia Island, but you start to think, okay, this is maybe something that people tell each other as a story in like 2000 years, you know, who knows? Like, so that's why I really like to work with it, because I feel like it's like a conversation, you know, it's a conversation with, of course, a really heavily distracted neural network. I certainly see value in it, like in a broadening of realities.
These are only fragments of a world I've never seen. Oral history is all there is, never meant to be rediscovered.
I like to have this idea of what you're working on, and based on the story from the field you just told, and to also how we collectively have a memory and mm-hmm. remember things, which has a lot to do with archiving mm-hmm. and what is saved and what is not saved, which stories are told and made visible in that sense. So this environmental literacy that we have of the environment, but also literacy of seeing things that not everybody can perceive, is all based on knowledge that we have. So jumping to this AI thing that you said, I wondered if you see AI and algorithms today as an archive of the current time for the future. Is it a collective memory that is sort of saved?
Well, I believe that AI is also, I mean, with AI, you always have this human factor, right? I don't believe in the AI having an own consciousness and taking over the world. You know, you always have this human factor behind it. I mean, the question is also, what do we mean when we talk about collective memory, right? Is this collective based on nationality? Is this collective based on a certain group? The question is also, what group do I want to be part of or see myself being part of? And what memory does this group contain or preserve? I wouldn't say that AI is archiving a collective memory or anything, because there are power structures in this also, and some things are more represented than others.
Thanks. Because, and then also I would like to talk more about chapter one landscape for a bit, because that is a way of telling a story about a 25th clone of a human who finds, well, not an AI. Or does it? It finds a 3D scan, right? Mm-hmm. So like a digital work, tries to find out if that is an archive, if I'm correct.
Oh, what I imagined was that, I mean, it all happened with, maybe I can briefly talk about the trip that we took. On this field trip, I noticed that other people were collecting samples, for example, seagrass or stones or sand or whatever, to work with them later in the lab. I decided to do 3D scans because we were at this place which would probably be underwater already right now if it wasn't for Delta Works or, you know, other storm surge barrier constructions. And depending on controlled flooding, it might be underwater in quite some time or not that far away. So I really liked the idea to preserve something or take something from like a glimpse of a moment at a specific time, at a specific place. And I try to imagine what a future being would think if they would find this 3D scan long after this place has already been gone. This is why I took a 3D scan of different parts of seagrass. And then later, that's how this work developed, also with the help of the AI to write the script for the video and the audio part of it. And it's a reflection of reality, of fragments of reality.
And you write in your artist statement that you also like to do, like to engage in a post-digital practice. Could you explain what that means? Does it relate to the work you just described?
Well, I think the term, I mean, a lot of people have really different ideas about this term. And when I use this term, I don't really mean to come back to a non-digital practice. For me, post-digital practice means more that I accept the fact that we are engaging so much in digital worlds, and I like to think more about, you know, where's like what I said before, where's this border between reality and virtuality, you know? And if I'm making these 3D worlds out of assets from the real world, which I digitalized, you know, myself or took from other people who digitalized assets of the real world, then yeah, where's the border?
All right, so that's what the post is for, to indicate that there's not really a separation between digital and real, because digital is real.
To me, that's a post, yeah. To me, that's a post. But I think, I mean, this is a really new field of really new theoretical field. I once saw that, for example, in architecture, you would say more that you don't have these mock-ups, you know, these 3D AutoCAD, whatever mockups, where you have little people, you know, walking through these models, digital models of architecture, but more going back into working with your hands and having a representation of these architectural models through analog practices. To me, it means more like accepting the fact that it's not easily distinguishable anymore, you know. And I also don't like the idea of the digital being something bad or being something apocalyptic. We just have to use it right. And if we use it in a form of expanding our perception and the possibilities of understanding the world, then this is my aim in a way.
You said it's good not to use it as to see digital as a negative thing. Because it depends how we use it, and it's important to look how we are spreading information, how we are storing information, maybe in the sense that you did with the seagrass in Chapter 1 Landscape. Chapter 1 Landscape is also about a quite far future where humans have gone extinct, right? And there is a clone, 25th clone of a human looking kind of back into this time, like 2020-ish. Do you look at that time, at the future, as we could call it, as a dystopian world? Do you work with ideas of utopia and dystopia, or are you more interested in other kinds of framing the future?
Of course, I'm super interested in the future because this is the reason why I work. I'm interested in working like that. I would say that I don't really have idea. I wouldn't think in dystopia or utopia. I don't have an idea of the outcome of anything, right? That's the reason why I'm more interested in the, how do you say that in English? The past. Sorry. then I'm more interested in the past. I mean, of course, like Chapter 1 Landscape is concerned with the future. But I also think, like, from the future into the past, like, of course, I'm creating like the present in this video is the future, but this future being is talking about the past and it's not looking into the future. And I also feel like this future being is quite abstract also. And sometimes it doesn't really make sense what it says, you know, and sometimes you don't really understand it. So I think I'm more concerned with the past. And I believe that if you are concerned with the past, it could make for a better future.
Working with digital works, 3D models, AI, anything virtual, you might miss the experience of going into the field, as you might call it. So when you use all of your sensory system to experience a place, as opposed to, you know, working on a computer. So I'm wondering if you ever miss any of the senses when you work through the other media.
Well, I mean, you also asked me about smell, right? And I find it interesting, or other forms of perception of the world and of the world. And I found it interesting that especially smell is something that I'm super crazy about. Like there can be scents where I have to stop whatever I do, you know, and just smell them. But I was thinking about working with smell in terms of like a room insulation or video insulation before. But I'm still debating, what do you want to communicate with this? Because my aim is certainly not to reproduce or reconstruct a specific place or illustrate all elements of this specific place. And in terms of, do I miss other sensory experiences? I do not really think that one encounter with reality will rule out other encounters. I think that you can visit a new media room installation and go for a walk afterwards. I just believe that you could experience that walk differently. What I like about room installations especially is that they can give you food for thought, and they can also give you an experience, like really bodily experiences. Bodily experience, maybe that's the DJ in me also, that I really like the bodily experience. It can give you a change of perception and reality. I just believe that people may think differently about the world if they came into a room. And, you know, I don't know, I feel like if you like room installations, then you really know what I'm talking about. If you go into a room and it gives you a totally different space and totally different time, and you kind of lose the feeling of self. And I really believe that if it's done right, like if it's done good, then you can leave that room. And, you know, the best outcome of it is that you perceive your surroundings in a different way, and maybe this results into a more caring approach.
And a more caring approach towards the environment, towards other people. Do you have a specific example for, maybe? Is there any kind of installation that you're still thinking about now when you talk about installations that is really stick to your mind?
Yes, but I don't know the name. I don't know the name of it, but I saw it at Vienna. I saw one installation, room installation in Vienna once 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where they would always close up the windows in the whole room every evening when it was connected with tide and low tide and high tide times. And there were, I don't remember how many, but more than 30 loudspeakers in this whole room, and everything would go dark, and there would be just a sound installation for an hour from a sonograph, you know, somewhere in the ocean, and you would hear like this whole world, and it just gave me this, gave me this feeling of trance, you know, where you're sitting there on the floor of this gallery for an hour, and you're just listening to, like, totally in the dark, you're just listening to sounds from the ocean. This was really impressive to me. And of course, then the question is, you know, what follows? Do you think about the ocean more then or not? But I feel that you kind of got a glimpse into a world that you know nothing about. And it just makes you more aware of it, that there's something more and something different that you don't really have that access to. But you kind of got this glimpse through this installation, which I think I really value.
That's interesting. It reminds me of something that is happening in humanities the past few years. It's called the Blue Humanities. Maybe you've heard of it. Among others, Stacey Alimo is writing about this a lot. She wrote a book. It's called Exposed. And she says it's very, very interesting to look into the underwater world and the ocean and the deep sea as a place of inquiry, because it's so radically non-human in many ways. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to identify with and to relate to, especially mm-hmm. deep sea creatures, so that it mm-hmm. could give us an idea of how to see the world through radically mm-hmm. different viewpoints. Mm-hmm. So that it's kind of you could call it an extreme version of what's happening in the ontological turn with interspecies studies and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And many of the authors in humanities and social sciences like anthropology who write about it, I think they are also very much supporting the idea of collaborations with artists, because mm-hmm. these things, these installations that you talk about, mm-hmm. they might give a voice in a way or a stage to a radically non-human world. Mm-hmm. As I recall correctly from seeing your website a while ago, you did a photography project about relations to the non-human.
Yeah, I did. I did one photo series, three photos about. It was in the Judean Hills, to Jerusalem, in the outskirts of Jerusalem, and there was this place where you have these terraces, and nobody really knows. I mean, research is not really. There are some ideas who made them, you know, but nobody really knows like the purpose of it and who made them, who created them and when. And I just really like to stroll around there and imagine, you know, because there are some places where you don't really, also again, the borders, you know, you cannot really distinguish between the natural world, so-called natural world, and the so-called man-made or human-made world. Because sometimes there was a pile of rubble, you know, you don't know, did somebody bring them here? Is it from the ground? Was it a fence? Yes, this was concerned with that, because I just really liked the blurring again of the so-called human-made and so-called natural world.
And by looking into the blurring boundaries between the natural world, so-called, and the human world, do you think you're also so making a bridge in a more maybe a more political way, where we can open up more towards what we used to call others? So where this process of othering between, for example, human, non-human, virtual, and real can be bridged?
Well, I think it's a tricky thing. I think what can be bridged is that we have to realize that we should be concerned about the landscape and not nature so much, because nature is just there, you know. This is, I think, an important realization that when we talk about climate change, it's about our own existence, right? It's also really maybe egocentric. Not to say that you shouldn't do anything about it, but I don't think that people really realize that it's about our existence and our existential basis. But of course, it's also affecting others, so-called others, if it's species, you know, or plants or whatever, because we are creating the biggest change, and not in a good way. So, and I think making bridges to others, I'm not sure. I mean, it's logic that when you talk about, you know, okay, our existential basis, and this is the landscape that we have to, you know, see differently to conquer, or, you know, to do something about climate change, we should automatically relate to so-called others. But I'm not sure if that's really happening, because I also don't think that anybody realized when you talk about migration, for example, you know, we are in Western Europe, we are going to be the last people probably to really feel the changes, you know, and it's super egocentric not to care about it so much. So, but I'm not sure if this is creating bridges then, because I feel like it's like the principle of ignorance, you know. And but it's also not the if you talk about art, for example, or academia, or why, you know, why do you write? Who do you write it for? Why do you make this installation? Who do you do it for? I'm not sure if it's to convince people that are ignorant, you know, to do something or be aware. I think it's just, maybe I'm trying more to empower or underline, you know, the thoughts of people that already are aware of it.
But in a sense, it seems from what you describe so far as your work that you're also underlining the voices or the stories of people that are usually not told. But yeah, maybe it's the difference, like, or it's the question to what kind of audience you could bring it, because in many cases, I feel like, for example, in academia, it's almost impossible to communicate the stories to a very wide public audience. And I think in art, this might as well be the case. People mm-hmm. going to galleries or exhibitions or installations are already interested in the topics and open to see that.
Well, I think this is also the reason why I really like to be concerned with the past so much, because I think that being concerned with the past is being concerned with understanding the present. And I am especially interested and working with marginalized positions, you know, because also in my own biography, I feel like there's a lot of unfairness, you know. I feel like not in my own, but in my family's biography, due to migration, you know. And what positions do you have then? And you know, like, what working positions do you have? What opportunities do you have in a society where you migrated to? And you're not automatically part of, this is kind of like my it feels good to cope, you know, with these thoughts and concerns in a way to make marginalized stories visible, you know. And this is also, you know, we talked about engraved landscapes. I believe that all these stories are there, we have to make them visible, you know. And I want to fight against like this oppression of making the disguising certain stories and amplifying others. And I think this, through this perspective, you can look at many different things, you know, and ask yourself, like, what is being amplified and why, even though it's all there equal, it should be all there equally, but like, it depends on what you take out of all these stories that are in the landscape. Or in the, you know, in history, in the landscape. I feel like it's kind of also the same, you know. The history is engraved in the landscape, and it's sometimes collective history, it's sometimes individual history, but who's part of collective and who's not?
Yeah, and then also who is part of nature and who's not?
These are only fragments of a world I've never seen. Oral history is all there is, never meant to be rediscovered.
In a lot of cases, I think that indigenous communities are seen more as part of the landscape than of the human side of the story, if there would be this kind of dichotomy. Especially, it has always obviously been extremely important to look at the history, but it's not always gotten equally enough attention. And I think today when we speak in this context, these months, a lot of Black Lives Matter protests have been on the streets, and discussions in the media about that history needs more attention could be very much related as well to the broader scope of the landscape and how environmental oppression has not been very clear, and also the important link between racism and environment. It's a very weird field because in a lot of perceptions in the media, it seems like there's two topics. One, like in the papers, for example, there's climate and there's social inequality and racism and sexism and stuff. But it's very much related. Did you ever encounter the relationship between environment, any kind of social inequality?
I find it interesting that you said that about, you know, the human space and the natural space, and that many indigenous communities are still today, I think, more localized in the natural world. I mean, we can also then, you know, all these things pop up in my head about colonialism concerning environment or climate and racism. I will never understand why people don't connect all these things that you just said, you know, because you have to understand this interconnectedness or these connections to understand the world in a way. And you will never, of course, fully understand the world because I don't believe there's one truth. But racism and climate, I was recently talking about exile and migration and refugeeness, you know, and all these different conditions and why they are separated, even though I think also historically exile is more like a collective, also artistic or avant-gardistic, in some cases modern idea of migration. And exile is always violence, right? Like, violence is the reason why people have to go into exile. And I was talking with a friend about that right now, if you look at migration or the condition of refugeeness, there's always violence, and it doesn't have to be a war. It can also be, you know, starving because of climate, because of capitalist structures and systems, you know, because you cannot find a job or whatever. I feel like this is also a thing that we have to think about. Why do we separate these things? Climate justice and capitalism, and it's all part of a violent system, you know? And I think this is something we really have to, because climate refugees will be a really big group also in the future.
And also maybe it would be interesting to look into the migration of different kinds of landscape, how landscape changes, or how your personal environment has changed during COVID-19. Also, one thing I was thinking about while making this, or like thinking about the podcast in general, the whole series, I started from my idea of making it about the non-human, and then kind of realized that it's, like you said, everything is so much connected that you automatically cover many topics if you want to talk about it in a more holistic way.
You just said, you know, like all these things that are related to each other, and I think this is also an interesting topic about, and also, you know, artistic research or having connections between academia and arts and technology, that I think you have to think more associative. Like, there's no other way around it. Connection is, I think, a really, really important word in this. What I really like about artistic research, for example, is that you can just make assumptions. Of course, I'm always trying to base it on research, you know, but the ways you come to these assumptions or test the assumptions out don't have to be super scientifically correct, you know, and that's why I also talked about the idea of montage, you know, and like Sergei Eisenstein said that it's a form of knowledge production in a way, you know, you put things together and you produce knowledge.
Thanks. I like to have this idea of what you're working on, and that you could to make it more specific. Thanks a lot for listening to this first interview of the new podcast series. Hopefully it sparked your imagination about our connections to the landscape, our collaborations with technology, and the blurry lines between fact and fiction. as well as the intersection of scientific and artistic research. Stay tuned for more podcast interviews in this series, Beyond Human Relations.
For show notes and more information, please visit futurebase.org. The sound fragments are sourced from Vanessa's art. You can find the links on our website. Thank you for listening.